We invite you to share in this experience and become more aware.
Good afternoon and welcome to Aware. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. We've had a lot of guests on in the past talking about the meat industry and the cover-ups that go along with this multi-billion dollar industry. We've spoken to John Robbins, who chose to not be the successor of his father's million-dollar ice cream business, Baskin-Robbins, because of his strong convictions against the dairy and its health ramifications in all the dairy industries. We've spoken to Howard Lyman, fourth-generation cattle farmer, almost died from a debilitating disease, which he linked to eating meat once he stopped eating meat and is now a full vegan, saved his life, turned his life around. So now, since December 30th, 2003, just a month ago, did the mainstream media finally start covering the meat industry because of this sudden onset of mad cow disease? Is it all of a sudden just hit the United States? I don't think so. We have done so many shows on the fact that it existed here in the United States for a long time. However, it isn't being tested. It isn't being covered. There are so many statistics that I wanted to bring to the table here. I want to cover some things that we've covered before on the show, and I just want you to hear it again because maybe now we're ready to hear this. Last year, 2003, the United States tested fewer than 25,000 cattle for mad cow disease, while about 35 million were slaughtered. It takes over 2,500 gallons of water to raise 1 pound of U.S. beef, while 1 pound of potatoes requires only 24 gallons of water. Some of the statistics we covered from John Robbins' book. There are now 20 billion livestock on Earth, more than triple the number of human beings. The most consolidated in factory feedlots, producing 130 times more waste than people. 130 times more waste. The infectious agent of mad cow disease remains infectious even after the exposure for an hour to temperatures exceeding 680 degrees and can withstand antibiotics, boiling water, bleach, and formaldehyde. It is a very toxic, disease. We've assembled a panel for you today to give you the truth behind the mad cow scare, some of the information and statistics the mainstream media isn't giving you. Joining me to do this is Mark Levendale, who's with me in studio. You might remember Mark from the Milk Show that we did, that great expose on the dairy industry. He's a health researcher. He's done extensive research on food allergies. He has a great book out called Quality Longevity: Discover How You Can Become Free of Health Problems, Lose Excess Weight, and Add Years to Your Life by Eating Foods That Are Compatible with Your White Blood Cells. Very interesting book. And also joining us on the line is Dr. Michael Greger. He was the chief mad cow investigator for Farm Sanctuary since 1993. He's joining us on the line. He's also the Mad Cow Coordinator for the Organic Consumers Association. That would be us. Welcome to the show, Mark Levendale. Thanks for being with me inside the studio here.
It's my pleasure. It's always good to be with you.
You too. And thanks for being with us also, Dr. Greger. Thanks for being on the phone with us.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I have a frog that's been in my throat for a couple of weeks now. Just, that kind of sound a little funky, but don't mind me. It's great to have you guys on and to bring this information about. First of all, I want to get to some basics, which the listeners could benefit from learning. And if you know this already, just hang with us. What, Dr. Greger, how did the technical term for mad cow come about? I mean, from bovine spongiform, and so, well, you can pronounce it. How did that become mad cow?
Bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Bovine means cow or cattle. Spongiform means sponge-like. And encephalopathy means brain disease. So this is a sponge-like brain disease of cattle. And many of the symptoms that we see not only in the people that eventually come down with this from eating infected meat, but in the animals themselves, is this kind of shaky, aggressive, kicking, can't walk kind of image. And so the British press dubbed that mad cow disease. They did not look quite sane.
Okay. And these are, and if you could just speak up a little bit for us, Dr. Greger, these are the downer's cows. Is that the correct term from, not quite correct? Mark is taking a second.
No, it's not quite correct. There's actually two different ailments. We have mad cow disease, which is starting to be well-studied with lots of room to go. But there's another whole disease, which is called Downer cow. And these are cows which collapse, unable to get into the feedlots and into the slaughterhouses. And up until about 3 weeks ago, these cattle were still being fed to people in the United States against protests among a number of scientists, because the actual cause of Downer cow disease is not known, but it may also be caused by these prions that cause mad cow disease. But the actual science isn't known because the research just hasn't been done yet.
Now, these Downer cows are the cows that are eating feed that consists of other cows.
Yeah, that's particularly true with the mad cow disease. That's been well established that they took sheep brains and they fed those to cows to fatten them up more and to increase milk production. And the sheep had a disease called scrapie, which then transferred over to the cows, and then in England and in a few other countries also transferred over, and worldwide has killed about 143 people so far.
People?
Yeah, that's 143 people have been caused by mad cow disease. What the statistics are on Downer cow disease are not well established because the research simply hasn't been done. It was first discovered by a veterinarian in this country in 1979, Stanley Presser. And Stanley Presser did the work on the mad cow disease. William Hardow did the work on mad cow disease, but for 16 years he was unable to get his work published because they just didn't want to look at the disease. They're still not looking at it.
That is the main problem that I'm seeing here, is that, I mean, there's been books written about this. It's existed in the United States for far longer than it finally hit the press. Now, why do you think that that is the case? Why now did it just surmount to this level that it couldn't avoid it hitting the press any longer?
Well, it's like the old story, the cow got out of the barn, and so now they're working on the barn door, and they can't deny that this disease has gotten into this country. Prior to this single cow that's come down with it in the state of Washington, they could claim this wasn't an American problem. So they have been doing very insufficient levels of testing compared to the countries who are really experts in this field.
Single cow is I mean, how can there just be one cow?
Well,
and that's what's on everyone's mind.
Right. There may well be far more, and they're not sure yet, but what they know there are more of is of these Downer cows. There's actually been somewhere between 200,000 and 1 million Downer cows fed to humans over the last several years. They don't know the numbers because they're really not testing for it and don't know the cause of the Downer cow part of the problem.
Now, there was this article, I think it was in the Columbia Basin Herald, Washington State newspaper, and it started off by saying, "My name is Dave, and I work at Vern's Moses Lake Meats. I did until the day the mad cow test results on the sunny Dean cow came back positive for BSE. He refused to be a part of this government cover-up any longer, and he did a whole expose on, you know, he went out to the media, and he said, you know, when they asked, was the cow in the food chain? And he said, of course, it's meat. Where else would it be? Of course it was in the food chain. And he, you know, gave a very clear expose on what's going on. And we've heard it from Howard Lyman. We've heard it from so many people over the years, but our government hasn't done anything about it. Now, Dr. Greger, what do you see our government doing about mad cow disease?
Well, we certainly haven't been doing enough. There are two major glaring omissions from the tiny inadequate concessions that they made on December 30th, and that is, one, they didn't talk about increasing testing. We need to dramatically increase surveillance
they
testing
didn't?
Like they do over in Europe, like they do over in Japan. In Japan, every cow slaughtered for human consumption is tested before it enters into the human food chain, which we could do well to follow here. And the second omission is that they continue these cannibalistic feeding practices that caused the disease in the first place. So we're still in this country feeding slaughterhouse waste, blood, and manure to farmed animals in this country. And if we continue to do that, then the disease will just spread.
We were looking at an article this week in the LA Weekly about the meat industry, and it stated that George Bush, former governor of Texas, the nation's top cattle-producing state, and the number one recipient of the industry's campaign contributions, George Bush is. And this cycle and the last election cycle, he was the number one recipient of the meat industry's campaign contributions. So maybe that's why George Bush told the American public on New Year's Day, I ate beef today, and I will continue to eat beef. I don't do a good George Bush. But it's a multi-billion dollar industry. We're talking the meat industry, the dairy industry, the whole, both industries, it's huge. Is there anything, I mean, when this was announced in England, they slaughtered more than half of the cattle in England, which destroyed the meat industry there.
Well, I think it's important to look at what they did in England, because they actually made the same mistake in England that we made here. Several years went by where they were trying to deny the existence of this or the importance of this, and originally all the experts assured the population that this disease that was in their cattle could not pass over to humans. And then humans began dying with this prion caused disease, and they had to address it, and then but that time they had to play catch up, and so that's why so many million of their cattle had to be killed. About a third of their herd altogether was killed. Fortunately in this country, it didn't get started here, or we might have made a similar mistake, which would have just been catastrophic, because in this country, for every person, for every three people, there is a cow or a steer, so we're talking about nearly 100 million cattle in this country, so the slaughter would have been even much greater in England. But we haven't learned from their mistake, because we are now lagging way behind them and playing like this isn't a problem with mad cow disease, and we're playing catch-up now on mad cow disease, and we really are just getting started on the downer cow disease. And while the downer cow disease has actually been recognized since 1979, it didn't get into the literature till 16 years later because the journals just wouldn't publish on it.
Dr. Greger, what would you feel? I mean, you're the chief investigator of Mad Cow, essentially. What do you see as the biggest cover-up?
Well, I mean, I think the linchpin here is the inadequate testing. I mean, they've been pretending this kind of don't look, don't find policy. I mean, the reason why we haven't uncovered more cases is because, you know, Americans have been eating all the evidence. They have not been adequately testing for this disease. And as you point out, you know, there's no such thing as a single mad cow. There's no such thing as an isolated case of mad cow because, you know, it comes from the feed, and, you know, cows don't get individual little TV dinners. You know, this one Washington Holstein evidently ate infected feed 4 or 5 years ago, and so did many other animals. And, you know, we can try trace forwards and trace backs where the feed go. We don't have a cattle ID system, so we don't know where these infected animals are. The only thing we can do to determine the true extent of the crisis is to test, either test all older animals like they do over in Europe, which would mean, you know, at least 6-7 million animals every year, or as the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations just recommended we do last week. But instead, we claim we're still going to only do 0.038 million or 38,000 next year, which, frankly, is not enough if we really want to determine the extent of the crisis.
Who pays for this testing?
The testing would be foisted onto the consumers and should add about a penny per hamburger, so about 4 to 6 cents per pound of hamburger meat. And
why the consumers? Why not the meat industry?
Well, I mean, it may be subsidized by the government and hence be a burden for the taxpayers. But the current plans are that the beef industry would pay for it, and they would just pass on
to right,
presumably pass on the cost to the consumer.
Now, when this happened in England, when half the cattle in England were slaughtered, did it not drive up the cost of meat and make the cows simply pretty much like cattle in India? They were invaluable. I mean, was there a lot of cow stealing going on?
Actually, what happened was that the British public started to become quite aware of this, and they cut way back initially on their eating of beef, and thus the price of beef dropped. And at the same time, the potential for health of the British would have gone up, because besides the mad cow disease problem with beef, it's also very high in saturated fat. It's also very high in cholesterol. And it's also dangerously high in protein. So there's a number of things about beef which are a significant problem above and beyond whether the cow was infected with mad cow disease. One of the keys that's very important, and that is that we know there's a problem with these prions, and so we need to be proactive. In other words, we need to stop, in my opinion, feeding cattle, dead cattle, to other animals until they are totally sure how the wide scope of this, because this disease has actually been around for some time. There was an outbreak in the feeding of mink back in the 1960s in the United States. They were fed cattle remnants, and it started killing mink on mink farms. And in fact, this continued on up until 1985, when an entire mink farm was, all the minks were killed because of eating contaminated beef with this prion-type disease. So we've had plenty of opportunity to study this. This is a much bigger problem than the government's making out to be. It's got into the wild elk and deer, and in a number of states now that they are not safe to eat. So this problem is much larger, not well understood, not well defined, and I feel rules need to be put in effect where animals are not, their remnants are stopped being fed to pigs and chickens and fish.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. What about mad fish, mad turkey? Well, we'll talk about that in a second, but wasn't there a bill passed, Dr. Greger, December 30th, 03, to make it illegal to sell meat from infected cows?
Well, actually, the cemetery wasn't a bill. It was an announcement by the USDA. There's actually two bills coming before the House as the second session of Congress starts up. And they're actually quite good bills. George Miller and Ackerman are putting out some decent bills to dramatically increase testing, get rid of some of these cannibalistic feeding practices. What the December 30th announcement did was but they planned on excluding all downer cattle, all cattle too sick or injured to walk, from the human food chain. Now, downer cows have already been excluded from the federal school lunch program because they were considered too risky for our school children.
That's like a no-brainer.
Of course, they weren't considered too risky to feed the kids when they got home from school or to feed the adults.
God.
But at least for a little while, they've been excluded from there. But now, the downer cattle are not going to be fed to human beings at all in the U.S. But the next question is, well, where's it going to go? And the brains and spinal cord, the most risky tissues from these downer animals, are being fed to pigs, pets, and poultry. That's where it's all going to go. It's going to be out of the human food chain and into the animal food chain, and then it can go right back into cows, spread this disease. It perhaps can be passed along to people that way. And so we need a total ban on feeding slaughterhouse waste, blood, and manure to farm animals like they do over in Europe, not this kind of partial ban which prioritizes business interests over the consumer.
It's so important what you said, and that whole statement was wonderful. But in the beginning, when you were saying they are banning the downer cows from the food chain, now these are these old, debilitated, crippled, disease-ridden cattle. Isn't that a no-brainer? They shouldn't have been in the food chain in the first place? I mean, why would they even have...
Well, the reason that they're in the food chain is because they bring about a great deal of profit for the beef industry and the Cattlemen's Association. And in turn, they have a lot of influence over the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The U.S. Department of Agriculture primary concern is for the farmers and ranchers to make money. It's not the health of the American public. So they come out with recommendations for people that they should eat lots of these different foods. And when there's clear evidence that eating too much fat, protein, and cholesterol is causing heart disease, strokes, and cancers, but it's good for the ranchers and the farmers, so the Department of Agriculture promotes these unwise and unhealthy practices.
Is the, I'm just reading from the Economic Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, these statistics could be skewed, but it says that beef, the beef industry dollar value is up from 2002, $65 billion, to 2003, $70 billion. Now, the cattle production is up, the beef production is up, and exports is up. Do you think that this would actually make a dent in that, if there has been a rising amount of increases from 2000 through 2003? Do you think that there is a chance that this could, you know, this outbreak of mad cow that we've finally seen in the news could make a significant impact?
Yeah, it could make a great impact, because what we have going on right now in this country, and even spreading to Europe, is a craze that eating high-protein diets, which are also high in fat and cholesterol, are a good way to lose weight. The South Beach diet, oh, the old Atkins diet, these are now so popular, it's driving up the prices of beef because Americans are desperate to lose weight, and they've been misinformed that you can eat lots of fat and lose weight and not lose your health. In fact, you lose your health as fast as you lose the weight.
Fascinating. We're going to do a show about this whole thing with Mark Levendale later, about the whole Atkins diet and how it has been infused into the media in a huge way. So very interesting stuff coming up about that. But question about Dr. Greger. I don't know if you know more about this, and we also have another guest that's coming up who's going to be talking to us from a biochemistry level. But John Robbins' book, The Food Revolution, talked about out of 900 million U.S. cattle slaughtered in the last 10 years, the USDA only tested 12,000 for mad cow disease. Now, that's what you're talking about in terms of the inadequate testing that's being done. But do you know about the link between mad cow in humans and Alzheimer's disease? And, Mark, you might also be prepared to talk about that.
Right. The person who actually did the original research that is the Stanley Prusner, he actually won the Nobel Prize for his work on the prions, and wrote an excellent article in Scientific American. And it's his feeling that prions may also be a contributing cause to both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. And other researchers are also looking at other diseases. But the research money just isn't there, and much of the risk of prion-caused diseases is being held from the public.
Okay.
A significant percentage of Alzheimer's is actually misdiagnosed, unfortunately. So when you do autopsy studies, what these presumed Alzheimer's deaths, between 1% and 13% of Alzheimer's deaths, it says Alzheimer's on the death certificate, actually turn out to be Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, this human spongiform encephalopathy. So that means thousands of Americans could be dying from this disease, and some of these so-called sporadic cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease may be indeed caused by eating infected meat. And so I encourage anyone who's listening who tragically knows someone with Alzheimer's disease that make sure that with, of course, the families and their permission, that an autopsy is done afterwards, because otherwise, they just write Alzheimer's on the death certificate and the body's buried, and we will never get a sense of how many people are dying here in the U.S.
There was a U.S. study done that when people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease were examined after death, over 5% of the presumed Alzheimer's victims actually did have CJD, which is the human variation of mad cow disease. So it's a huge number of people. I'm reading from The Food Revolution from John Robbins' book.
It was actually done at Yale, 6 out of 46. And these were people who were diagnosed by Yale physicians, to the best of their ability, that they were clinically diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So they looked at a series of 46 of them and found out that 6 actually died of this Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or about 13%. 4 million Americans are afflicted with Alzheimer's disease. It is now, according to the Centers for Disease Control, the 8th leading cause of death.
So 13% of 4 million Alzheimer's victims had mad cow disease.
Well,
that's a high statistic.
Alzheimer's death. I mean, so these were autopsy studies, and so about 50,000 people die from Alzheimer's every year. Even though 4 million are currently affected, they don't all die every year. That's the difference in it. So it's thousands. So there are
5,000, 6,000
of Americans probably afflicted with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease based on these studies. And we don't know what percentage of them are coming from infected meat, but it could be from the beef, it could be from the lamb chops, could be from scrapie, it could be from pork as well. We have a number of epidemiological studies that have linked this Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease with pork consumption, particularly processed pork products like ham, something called scrapie, pork brains, etc.
Well, we're going to find out about us cheese eaters afterwards. If we don't eat meat, it's really the same thing, cheese. We're going to come back, and we're going to be speaking with Dr. Colin Campbell. He's going to be joining us. He's a professor of nutritional biochemistry at Cornell University. And we're going to continue with Mark Levendale. And Dr. Greger, will you stay with us as well?
Yes.
Great. We'd love to have you back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Aware on KPFK. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Aware. Hi, this is Lisa Garr, and we're doing a roundtable discussion here on mad cow disease, some of the information you're not going to get from the mainstream press because either they don't have enough time to cover it because there's so much information, or there's just not the willingness to disclose this information because of vested interests by the government. Blah, blah, blah. We know that story pretty well. Joining me on this panel is Mark Levendale. He is a health researcher, done extensive research on food allergies. Also joining us is Dr. Michael Greger. He is the chief investigator of BSE, of the mad cow disease, and also the coordinator, the mad cow coordinator for the Organic Consumers Association, which I still want to get to you about. And also joining us on the line is Dr. Colin Campbell. He is the professor of nutritional biochemistry at Cornell University. He's done over 40 years of research in diet and health. The director of a very incredible study called the China-Oxford-Cornell Study on Diet and Health, which is probably the most comprehensive study of diet and health in the history of medicine. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. So we've been speaking about mad cow disease and the recent discovery of mad cow disease in the United States. We've spoken for years on this show about the fact that it hasn't existed in the U.S. and is now finally the linchpin is this one cow in Washington, which is ironic that it would be just one cow that was found with this. Can you tell us a little bit about you've done a lot of research on cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about your findings on the link between cancer and red meat?
Yes, as you mentioned before, we organized a very large study in the People's Republic of China about 20 years ago and then subsequently did a lot of analyses on the samples that we collected and the information we collected. And what we were really interested in that particular study was not only to look at, let's say, the contribution of various and sundry foods and food groups, you know, to various and sundry kinds of diseases, including about a dozen different cancers. We also were interested in sort of looking at this whole question concerning the relationship between diet and disease in a more global, from a more global point of view. That is, I believe that the relationship between food and health, and this is basically what we're learning, is a very comprehensive effect involving lots and lots of different kinds of nutrients and other sorts of substituents that are present in the food. And so from that perspective, what we basically learned was that the introduction of animal foods actually increases the risk of a various and sundry kinds of diseases, including, of course, the cancers, heart disease, diabetes, and the rest.
Is there a specific type of cancer that is linked to red meat?
Well, we were looking about, as I say, about a dozen different kinds of cancers, which incidentally were geographically localized in China. They were very common in some areas of the country and not in others, and that's what made this study so attractive, to see what, in fact, really was going on. But as far as Western interests are concerned and other sorts of studies are concerned, as well as ours, colon cancer and breast cancer in particular are related this way. But quite frankly, when one looks a little more carefully at the relationship between food and these various cancers, I believe that we have really good evidence to suggest that the animal foods actually raise the risk for all these different kinds of cancers.
Now,
it's a very comprehensive effect and quite dramatic for some of these cancers.
you've done this research and you've done the study on this. Tell me about in China why certain regions were more apt to have these findings than others.
Well, that was the reason we got involved in the first place with, I might add, U.S. government funding to do that along with the Chinese government funding. But back in the 1970s, the Chinese had discovered that for about a dozen different cancers, as well as about three dozen or so other kinds of diseases, that they tended to occur in certain areas of the country and not in others. They did this massive survey on the causes of death for about 2,400 different counties. And the differences between the disease rates in some places and others was really quite dramatic, you know, several dozenfold, even several hundredfold. So we learned early on that cancer is a localized, geographically localized disease, and therefore what it was. And so we went to do the study to collect as much information as we possibly could on dietary and lifestyle characteristics in particular.
Colin Mark Levendale, when you were doing that study, did you see a direct correlation between the areas in China where they ate more meat and animal tissue and increased incidences of different cancers?
Well, it turns out that in China, as you know, Mark, the amount of meat that's actually consumed in the country is really very low, at least in rural China from the areas we looked at. And so, quite frankly, I did not expect to see any particular relationship, particularly with meat or specific kinds of meat in these various diseases. But when we got the results in, it turned out even small intakes, relatively speaking, of animal-based foods, including the meats, of course, small intakes of these kinds of foods were associated with increasing levels of blood cholesterol, for example, that's associated with heart disease, and increases in the various and sundry kinds of cancers. So I really don't want to put my finger on any one particular and specific kind of meat. It's just the animal foods as a class really are related to these diseases. And it's that reason that it's made it difficult for scientists over the years to sort of, in a sense, tease out the effects of one kind of animal food from another. Because if one increases, for example, meat beef intake at the expense of chicken or vice versa, one's not really changing things that much, or I should say it the other way around.
Now, what about cheese and milk and dairy,
though they're China, not cheese? They really don't consume, except in a few areas in the northern part of the country, in the Muslim areas of the country, they don't consume any significant amounts of dairy. In fact, in most of China, they consume none. So we really couldn't study that question very thoroughly, but it turned out that the areas that did, in fact, consume the most dairy, and these are, incidentally, milks from other kinds of animals, not just cows, that in those areas, the rates of breast cancer and colon cancer and heart disease was the highest.
That's very interesting. In the areas, Colin, where they did not eat any dairy products at all, did you see any detriments to their health, weak bones, any other, you know, calcium deficiencies or anything that the American Dairy Association would assume would happen to people?
Well, we did a study on the side after completing the big study, looking specifically at the relationship between food intake, and particularly interested in this dairy question in those areas of China where it occurred, the relationship between that, let's say, and bone density, which is an indication of osteoporosis, as you know. And basically what we found was that, first off, the rate of osteoporosis in China was only about one-fifth of what it is, here it is in the West, in spite of the fact that they don't consume dairy. And so the dairy industry has argued for years that dairy is a good source of calcium, and therefore should be protective against these diseases, whereas, quite frankly, in China, they don't consume dairy, yet have much lower levels of the osteoporosis.
And how about the bone, well, that is osteoporosis.
The bone density, yes.
Right.
much lower levels of osteoporosis and less bone density.
Okay. Now, in terms of the, you know, it's interesting because I saw an ad on the television the other day where there was, it was funny. There was a guy, a boy in the kitchen with his mom, and he was eating, I don't know, he was had a glass of milk there that he didn't want to drink. And the mom said, look, the neighbor doesn't drink milk. And there was this strange caricature of the neighbor who was pushing the lawnmower and his arms fell off. And it was the strangest ad, and it was just this week. And then she, in turn, said, see, milk helps build strong bones. And then the kid downs the milk. And I didn't think it was legal for them to say that any longer.
Well, there's a number of things that the dairy industry has done for the years that turned out to be illegal. They used to claim that milk is good for everybody, and the Supreme Court stopped them from saying that because a lot of people have allergic reactions to milk.
All
a
right.
lot of people have lactose intolerance. I also saw that ad you're talking about, and that is just a pathetic attempt on the part of the dairy industry to maintain their sales. People are beginning to notice they don't feel so well when they eat dairy products, and thus through the years they've been cutting back on them, and so we have these desperate ad campaigns like the mustache milk ads and the ones that you're seeing on television where people are falling apart because they don't have good milk for their bones.
Mm-hmm, that's interesting. Okay, so back to the mad cow conversation. we can go on a tangent here. Dr. Greger, who is still with us on the line, you are the coordinator for the Mad Cow coordinator for the Organic Consumers Association. What is the benefits of eating organic beef, and what are you saying to the organic consumers?
Well, in terms of mad cow risk, depends on what the animals ate, because it is indeed because these animals were being fed meat meal, bone meal, blood meal from other animals that they got this disease. And so if you feed these naturally herbivorous animals a vegetarian diet like they are forced to do by law for federally certified organic standards, it should be lower risk. But one cannot guarantee no risk even from organic beef because, for example, when these cows are slaughtered in the same slaughter facilities, and as you mentioned, it's very difficult to decontaminate some of this equipment. So I certainly wouldn't say it's no risk, and certainly has, you know, same saturated fat, some of the other things we were talking about. But from a mad cow standpoint, it's less risk. But obviously, the lowest, you know, there's no such thing as mad broccoli disease, and so certainly moving towards a plant-based diet makes sense from a number of these different perspectives.
Right. You were also an expert witness at the infamous Oprah Winfrey meat defamation trial. Has the meat industry retaliated in terms of the effects of sales and after that trial? Has there been any type of repercussions that you've seen since January or December 30th? What is your experience of that?
Well, I mean, the beef export business, which is worth about $4 billion, was absolutely destroyed. We now have 50 countries around the world that refuse. That are smarter than we are in this country and refused to sell American beef. In fact, in Korea, they were burning it. They took beef out of the schools in Japan because of the public schools because they were concerned that there might be some American beef sitting in there. And then what Japan is demanding is that we test all of our animals like they do over there to make sure that, you know, we aren't going to develop these brain-wasting diseases years down the line. These diseases have no treatment, no cure. They're, you know, the Britain's health secretary called the worst form of death imaginable, and I can only agree, having seen one case during training. It's the most horrible thing I've seen in my medical years, certainly. And so, you know, one case is too many, and unfortunately the death toll continues to rise over in Europe. And so, you know, we need to put practical, concrete, you know, precautionary measures in place now to protect the American public for the future.
What is the FDA doing about the the whole probable cause, which I understand is a probable cause, of mad cow in Washington State? It is probable. It hasn't been confirmed yet, right?
No, well, I don't think anyone seriously. It's been confirmed by the lab in the UK, which has really the best people working on this. And
okay.
So it has been confirmed that what strain it is, we don't know yet. Is this the British strain of mad cow disease, which seems to attack younger people? Or do we have our own native strain that's been wiping out mink farms, as was noted earlier, that may manifest itself differently and kill different age ranges and look differently on autopsy? And so, unfortunately, we don't have that data yet. But, again, we won't know the true extent of the crisis until we increase testing. And the FDA's role, USDA does the testing. The FDA role controls animal feed. And so, for example, the FDA continues to allow the feeding of cow blood to calves, this cow blood, the spray-dried raw cattle blood protein, to calves and their milk replacer, and we now know that blood is indeed infectious. We just had someone last month in Britain contract this horrible Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease from a blood transfusion, we think. And so the fact that the FDA still continues to allow this is unconscionable, although in the next few days the FDA claims they're going to make an announcement about new regulations. I would not be surprised if we finally close that loophole.
That would be very encouraging, but we'll see. We've been surprised before. Dr. Campbell, what other types of proteins are good for us to consume? I had a guest on a while ago talking about how animal protein helps elevate mood, fight against PMS, depression, ADD, many other brain fog-related dysfunctions. Do you, from a biochemical perspective, have an opinion on that?
Yes. Actually, that was my principal interest for many years, even before we did the China Project. And incidentally, when one talks about the effects of protein, for example, or any other nutrient for that matter, we can get short-term effects as well as long-term effects. And I've been primarily interested in the long-term effects, and sometimes the short-term effects are quite misleading. And so, nonetheless, when we compared the proteins and their ability, for example, to affect the experimental development of cancer, we found that animal protein, and specifically we were using the protein from cow's milk, when that was fed experimentally, we could basically turn on cancer growth, and when it was taken away, we could turn it off. It was very dramatic, and we studied it in great detail. We must have 100 publications in scientific literature on this, and it was so dramatic. The differences between the animal protein and the plant proteins, the plant proteins that we used were soy protein and wheat protein, and so and as far as the biochemistry is concerned, we know a lot about how it really works. And so I'm really confident that there is a big difference between animal-based proteins and plant-based proteins.
In terms of cancer?
Yes. And, well, in terms of also in terms of blood cholesterol levels and a number of other things as well. But I don't want to leave just the sort of the isolated statement that it is solely, that these effects are solely due to the question concerning what kind of protein and how much protein. It really turns out that there are many other things in foods as well. It just also happens that foods that contain animal protein also contain other things that are not helpful.
Like the saturated fats, is that what you're thinking about here, Colin?
Yeah, saturated fats and, of course, cholesterol and so forth. And obviously animal foods don't have really any significant amounts of the antioxidants that we all know are so valuable. It doesn't have any of the various sundry kinds of dietary fibers that are so valuable. And so when one contrasts on a more global basis the differences between animal foods and plant foods, you see these dramatic differences, which are borne out in population-based human studies, I should say.
But animal protein does have the amino acids that do clear up these brain fog-related dysfunctions.
I have to say, you know, people make these kinds of points, but that's really mythology.
Huh. Yeah, I wondered your opinion on that.
Yeah, well, that's my opinion. So.
No, keep going.
I mean, the thing is, we only need about 10% of our total energy in the form of protein in the first place. And it's best, in our experiences and the extensive work that we've done, it's best that that protein be furnished by plant-based materials.
And that's even if you're an extreme athlete to anything.
Well, 10% is enough. I mean, this has been recommended since 1943 by the U.S. government, and I quite agree with it. But it turns out that the amount of protein we consume in this country ranges between about 11% on the low side and 22% on the high side. And it's only the people, the athletes who pump an iron get up as high as 22 or a little bit higher, except for the recent interest in the Atkins diet, of course. And so we're consuming already excess amounts of protein as it is, and 70 to 80% of that is usually in the form of animal-based proteins.
It's a very important point here because the actual average in the United States for protein intake is around 16-17%, and that's above what is a healthy level. And then with the advent of these high protein low carb diets, that's even going higher, and we're going to see a epidemic of increases in both cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes from these diets that are high in protein, high in fat, high in cholesterol.
Now,
can I add one more thing to what Dr. Lovendale just said? This interest in protein has really become obsessive and excessive.
Is this Dr. Greger speaking?
No, this is Colin King.
Oh, hi. Sorry about that.
Yeah. The U.S. government for many years has been making recommendations on what we should be consuming, how much nutrients we should be consuming in particular. And the Food and Nutrition Board of the National Academy of Sciences has been making the recommendations on recommended intakes of nutrients, for example. They, in their most recent report, and they do this about every 5 years, in their most recent report, they now say that we can consume protein as high as 35% of calories and arguing that that's consistent with the reduction of these chronic diseases. I can't quite believe they actually did that. Previously, it was always 10%, and there wasn't an upper limit set. But now they're saying, you know, that we can consume as high as that. I mean, they've played right into the hands.
Right.
You know, the Atkins people.
And that's why the Atkins people are so successful right now. But what now I've seen their Atkins people defending the meat industry, and now this is in the news. This was in the news this morning. Mark, you've made a lot of links with this, haven't you?
Yes, the Atkins people have been claiming for years that high levels of saturated fat and high levels of proteins are fine. However, they have just admitted over the weekend in the New York Times that their diet does have at least one flaw in it, and that is that there's too much saturated fat, so they recommended a cutback in the saturated fat in the diet. And I think it's really important for people to understand that the promotion of high protein is not benign. There's a number of health problems. The protein above 10 or 12% of total calories begins to break down the kidneys. It demineralizes the body, a lot broad range of trace minerals as well as calcium out of the bones. So there's a lot of problems with it. And Colin, your work on showing that casein, the primary protein in dairy products, was harmful to people, I think, is as far as cancer is concerned, I think that research needs to get out there.
Yeah, we've made an attempt, but quite frankly, a lot of folks don't particularly want to hear it.
I had an author talking about how casein sets up an addiction in the body for things like cheese and chocolate and so forth, and it sends the body and the blood sugar, of course, into extreme highs and lows, resulting in high blood pressure.
Some of that can actually be caused by these delayed allergic reactions to foods, and it may not be the casein. It may be that the person has this delayed allergic reaction, which is often shown by Dr. Theron Randolph to be an actual physical addiction as well. So people have these food cravings to the foods that aren't good for them.
Yes.
And this is one of the major causes of the brain fog and attention deficit disorder are actually these delayed food allergies, and to try and treat them with some of the same foods that cause them, you get a short-term stimulant effect. So it may look good to give a child beef because it, in the short term it helps, but it just brings the problem back even worse the next day.
Fascinating. Yeah, that's interesting, and that's what your book is about in terms of the white blood cells?
Yes. The research that we've done has shown that an excellent way to find out which foods are compatible with your body is by combining an individual's white blood cells with each of the different foods and then studying them under the microscope. And if that food is damaging to the immune system, then you see the white cells break open and die, and you found one of these delayed food allergies. And I thank you, Colin, for the honorary doctorate degree. However, I'm not a doctor. I'm an independent health researcher. And
that's a great breakthrough, though, to be able to do that type of research. And that's the bottom line on food allergies is the blood testing.
But yeah, you've written an excellent book, Mark.
Thank you, Colin. And there's about 2,000 doctors around the country who use this approach for helping their patients. But it's very controversial because it tends to get the people healthy, and then they don't have to go back to their conventional allergist.
Good point. Well, we're all into that, and that's why we do an alternative health show here at KPFK. I just want to wrap this up. In terms of solutions here, Dr. Greger, what do you suggest, and what are you suggesting to us organic consumers?
Well, certainly, there was never a better time to make a New Year's resolution to move towards a plant-based diet. You know, we hear about the PCBs in the farmed salmon. We hear about the mad cow disease. The report just came out about arsenic in chicken. There's a real problem with the way particularly animal agribusiness has altered the food supply, and I think moving towards whole plant foods is really the best route, not only for prevention of infectious diseases, which strike 76 million Americans every year with foodborne illness, but also some of the chronic diseases. Yes, foodborne illnesses, food poisoning kills a few thousand Americans every year, but heart disease and cancer and stroke kill hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. And so to kind of step back and get the big picture, there are lots of reasons to all pointing in the same direction, and that's away from this animal-based foods and more towards whole plant-based foods.
I agree entirely. In fact, if you look at it, about 1 million people a year die from cardiovascular diseases of one type or another, and that figures out to about 3,000 people a day in the United States alone, which is about 120 an hour. So while we've been here talking about this today, about 120 people have died in this country because they've eaten too much beef, too much cheese, too much eggs, too much chicken, even too much fish. And over the last 10 years, only 143 people have died around the world from mad cow disease. So the perspective on this needs to be focused. And hopefully this focus on mad cow disease will get people looking at this overall subject and get them making much wiser choices as far as how they eat and getting their fully body compatible body needs from protein from plant-based foods.
And Dr. Campbell, what could you suggest to us as a solution to this, being a professor of biochemistry? What could you tell us, and what would you do?
Well, we've got to get a public discussion going. I really congratulate you on doing this, for starters. But recently, I incidentally had an opportunity of putting some figures together fairly simply, and very conservative figures at that. And it's I think I can make a very good argument at this point, that the number one cause of death in this country is ignoring and misunderstanding nutrition. Number one cause of death. And quite frankly, I'm using very conservative government-published figures to come up with these numbers. It's greater than, let's say, heart disease, cancer, all the rest.
What would you say the reason is for that we ignore nutrition?
Well, it's a long story. It has a very rich cultural, historical background as to how we got into believing that this is good food in the first place. I came from the farm myself, and from a dairy farm at that, and went away to school to study to figure out how to grow cows or get more of them. So, I mean, I've come from that background, and I know the kind of sort of feelings, I'm sure as the rest of you do too, about the reaction on the part of the public against information of this kind. They've been doing it for a long time. Their parents did it, their grandparents did it. But so that's why I come back to the main point, and that is to somehow figure out how to get more public discussion going on this.
Well, that is a great point, and that's what we're doing. And sorry, we're cut short here, but thank you for your contributions, Dr. Campbell. And Dr. Greger, thank you for joining us. And again, thank you for being with us in studio, Mark Lovendale. Any websites that you want to give out?
Yeah, mine is preventivecare.com, and anybody who wants to contact us there, we'll send them a full article on this mad cow disease, plus other things that they can use to improve their health.
Okay, and you can go to www.theawareshow.com for information on all of our guests today. Thank you very much for your contribution from today's panel. And that's it for me this afternoon. While I'm committed to bringing you the clearest information possible, in the end, I always encourage you to listen to your own truth. Until tomorrow, I invite you to stay aware.